Good afternoon. You're listening to Around the Block, a community news program from the Block by Block team at WPPMLP Philadelphia 106.5 FM. On this show, we explore issues in the Philadelphia region with voices from the community. Through original reports from our team of journalists and live interviews, I am Amanda Johnson.
And I'm Campbell Simmons. Coming up, we'll be speaking with an organizer from Socialist Alternative about how organizers, activists, and politicians in Philly are working to keep the city safe for immigrants and get ICE out of Philly. And with Philadelphia preparing to commemorate the country's 250th birthday, we'll take a look back at a bicentennial protest when tens of thousands of people took to Philadelphia's streets 50 years ago.
But first, graduate students at the University of Pennsylvania could go on strike this week. The union representing students has been negotiating its first contract with the university and has announced that grad workers could go on strike Tuesday if a deal isn't reached by then. Around the Block reporter Marion Nickvert is a former Penn grad student, and she interviewed a friend who's part of the union to find out more about the negotiations and some of the challenges that the union has faced.
My name is Massimo. I'm currently in my second year of a PhD program at Penn studying Italian and music, and I'm part of the graduate workers union, which is called Get Up, and part of UAW. UAW is the United Auto Workers Union. It is kind of like a larger parent organization for a lot of different smaller unions. And GetUp is kind of, you know, this smaller union that's within UAW.
The important question that I think is on everybody's mind right now is, what does a grad student at Penn do?
Your status changes a lot over the course of 4, 5, 6, 7 years, however long it takes you to do a PhD. So usually a lot of grad students, your first year, you're just taking coursework. So you're just going to classes, and it's a really beautiful period of being a grad student. As you progress, more and more responsibilities get added, the biggest of which, for at least my field, is teaching responsibilities. What work looks like for graduate students, be it teaching, be it research, be it other professional work, it can look really different over the course of your time at Penn.
You know, when you think of a university, you think of yourself as a student, right? And so you think that the university has your back and has your best interest at heart. And I wonder, how does that change when you're a grad worker?
I think about my own experience. I grew up in family housing on University of Michigan's campus, actually, when my mom was a graduate student there. So I learned about an institution from the ages of 2 to 7 as my mom's employer, where she went during the day, but also as a school that people had a lot of pride for. As a graduate worker, you definitely find yourself more on that side where you're less of a student and more of some weird in-between of, you know, instructor, researcher, worker. The university starts to be a lot more of your employer and less of the institution that you attend.
Negotiating the first contract right now with Penn. Mm-hmm. What was before that?
Before that, nothing really. I mean, when I agreed to accept the position as a, you know, graduate student, it's a very short document. The one kind of more quantifiable metric, I guess, that you get, that you sign to is your stipend amount. And that's really the only thing that I remember in terms of protections for discrimination, harassment. I mean, university, they have protocol, but we want something outside of that that's written into the contract for our position in particular. Something we hear a lot in our meetings is that it's a lot of foreign territory for most of us because, you know, a lot of us are a bit younger. A lot of us are going through this process of escalating to a strike for the first time. There was one article on ensuring a pocket of money for international and immigrant graduate workers to be able to finance trips back to, you know, their home country to get visa renewals. It can be a very costly process. Another one, giving health insurance for dependents who I think right now are uncovered, and there are very small amounts of money that are available on a grant basis. The usual things like including dental and vision and our health insurance. And the big one, of course, is stipend amount.
Trying to get a contract or a better contract. Is this the first time it ever happens in the history of the United States? Or is
No, this is very common. We've seen this a lot, you know, to varying degrees of success in organization, of course. A couple notable examples, you know, the Hopkins, they were able to ratify their first contract. Whereas in other cases, like the UC strike back in 2018, it was a pretty lengthy, drawn-out strike. I'm proud to say that Penn is now, you know, kind of joining the ranks of these other institutions who have immediately enshrined some of these really basic rights and protections for graduate students. The elephant in the room is that a lot of people are scared, for good reason, too. We're seeing an intensity of active terrorizing of people in our country. You know, it's always risky to get involved with organization at any capacity. Taking that bit of necessary risk is also fundamental to getting a contract that would then enshrine those very rights, you know, to be an international student or to be here and feel protected by the institution that your work is going to.
And how has being part of a union changed things for you?
Right now, a lot of people feel very powerless, just in general, in the country, in the world. And I think often something I'll hear people say is that going hyper-local, forming these small networks of resistance and communities can be really, really effective to actually get things to change. And I think right now, GetUp is kind of that for me. I think union organization is a really, I mean, it's valuable for its tangible possibilities, but it's also valuable just in the sense of seeing things in a different light.
You can find out more about Penn's Grad Student Union and the latest updates on the group's collective bargaining discussions with the university at getup-uaw.org. That's getup-uaw.org.
Philadelphia will be the center of attention this summer as the country commemorates 250 years since the signing of the Declaration of Independence. But many feel that the country hasn't lived up to the promises made in that document. And that's not a new idea. 50 years ago, tens of thousands of people took to the streets in Philadelphia to protest the celebration of America's 200th birthday. Around the blocks, Winter Schneider spoke with some of the people involved in that 1976 protest about their efforts to preserve the history of the march and to carry on its legacy today.
Organized by the Puerto Rican Socialist Party, the July 4th coalition turned out between 40 and 60,000 people to march for a bicentennial without colonies, for full democracy, equality, jobs, and a decent standard of living for all. It was what historians considered to be the largest political demonstration since the end of the Vietnam War the year prior, and it brought the issue of Puerto Rican independence to the fore. July 4th, 1976 was a Sunday. After a service at the Church of the Advocate, led by Father Paul Washington, the march assembled at 29th and Clearfield in North Philly before walking a two-mile route through Strawberry Mansion that ended up at 33rd and Oxford Street.
It was a beautiful day. There was such a diversity of, you know, some people carrying giant Puerto Rican flags. There were a lot of handmade signs with the slogans.
Tony Hariza was a recent college graduate and member of the New American Movement in 1976 when he helped organize a broad coalition of groups to come to the march in Philadelphia from Dayton, Ohio. He's now part of the July 4th Sin Colonias Coalition, working to build a living digital archive of the anti-bicentennial march in 1976. Paul Sokolar is another member of the group. He participated in the march as a rising senior at Haverford College, and remembers another aspect of that day 50 years ago.
The march was in the face of a massive police presence all along the route. There were actually sharpshooters on the roofs of houses. In the face of all that, it was a protest that went off entirely peacefully.
And joyfully, which not all political demonstration at that time had that. And this had an interesting energy because it was this optimistic, powerful, you know, feeling of people together, but with aspirations is really how it felt.
Imagine a huge mass of people made up of different contingents, all chanting chants and singing songs whose lyrics were repurposed for the occasion.
Independencia para Puerto Rico.
Stand up. Stand up for your rights.
Gay, straight, black, white, same struggle, same fight. At that time,
that was radical.
was radical, yeah. It's hard to overstate the level of excitement and energy at this march. It was just, you know, I think the combination of it feeling huge and incredible, diverse crowd, particularly the enormous Puerto Rican contingent. It was so exciting.
I asked Paul and Tony to give me a sense of why an anti-bicentennial march felt important at that time in U.S. history.
There were revolutions all around the Third World that were winning. You know, it was a time where it really made sense that we had a sweeping and ambitious program of demands, of a vision of really a different nation. The U.S. was in crisis economically and very polarized culturally. You know, it was not a good time to be a poor person or a working person. So the bicentennial hoopla did not resonate.
It was really a call for a real democracy rather than celebrating just the mythology of democracy.
In the months before the march, then Philadelphia Mayor Frank Rizzo requested that 15,000 federal troops and then the National Guard come to Philly to handle what he painted as a threatening and violent protest. His request, though ultimately denied, shows how leaders of the march were labeled as threats to American democracy.
I'd forgotten how much they used that, but it became the thing like Puerto Rican terrorist, right? Like that's not a current, it's these associations. Now it's, oh, you support Gaza, terrorist. But it's the same kind of sweeping thing.
It was a march that was led by Black and brown people. And this was such a clear case of the effectiveness of a Puerto Rican organization.
On the occasion of this year's semi-quincentennial, organizers of the July 4th Sin Colonias Coalition hope that learning about the 1976 march can spur critical reflection about our present conditions.
These historic milestones are opportunities to contest the narrative. The effort to try to remind people of this march is about that we can do that, that that's important work, and that we need to correct the false narratives about our history and talk about things like colonialism.
In our interviews, it felt clear that one of the most memorable aspects of the march was how it brought together a coalition of groups that hadn't been united before.
It generally was people who I knew, but we weren't necessarily united in a thing, right? We were kind of allies, but separate. And so this, for this time period, we were in a thing together. This was really a focus on a really massive change and overtly socialist politics, not for everyone in the march, but that was the ethos. And if these various communities came together, it's the kind of power that causes change. It still gives me hope that this can happen and that this is the way in which change really will happen. So I'm really happy to be part of sharing this experience with people.
You can keep up with the coalition on their Facebook page. Just search for July 4th Sin Colonias Coalition. This spring will feature events where the group hopes to connect with others who experienced the march in 1976 and to introduce this history to a new generation. For Around the Block, I'm Winter Schneider.
Over the last year, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, has been intensifying, kidnapping people off the street, detaining people, and harassing immigrant communities. ICE agents murdered Renee Good and Alex Preddy in Minneapolis in January, sparking massive protests in the city and a terrifying militarized backlash from ICE. But Good was far from the first death at the hands of ICE. 31 people died in ICE custody in the last year, and 6 more this January, including Parody Law, an Upper Darby father who died in ICE custody in a Philadelphia federal detention center. A number of groups in the Philly area have been working to fight ICE activity in the city, distributing Know Your Rights information, raising money for legal aid and those who have been detained, and hosting protests and other direct actions. Joining us in the studio to discuss this is Effie, an organizer with Socialist Alternative, one of the many groups in Philadelphia that has been working to keep ICE out of the region. Effie, thanks so much for joining us on Around the Block.
Thanks for having me.
So to start us off, could you explain a little bit about what ICE presence has looked like in the region thus far? Obviously, we aren't yet seeing the same degree as what's been happening in Minneapolis yet, but ICE has still been actively kidnapping and detaining people. Could you elaborate on what conditions have looked like thus far?
Absolutely. Before I dive into what's happening now, I do want to point out that ICE has been present in Philly for quite a while. The first office was set up around 2017 and included a pretty big grassroots movement against that facility getting set up. And so this is not new, right? The current abductions that we're seeing have absolutely been horrific. There's been over 100 kidnappings just outside of the courthouse alone. And that obviously doesn't include folks who are being abducted and detained in other areas of the city. With ICE's very questionable tactics, it's very hard to get a sense of exactly what is happening, right? They don't have uniforms that are standardized. They're using unmarked vehicles, all the same tactics we've seen in Minneapolis, but to, you know, a lesser degree here, but still very scary for neighbors and community members.
Okay. We hear a lot about the intensifying presence and violence of ICE. So how have people been combating this in Philadelphia? And people have different views. So what are some of the positive things that you've seen?
Yeah, there's been some really exciting work happening in Philadelphia, and I think we should be really proud of ourselves as a city. Cam mentioned in the intro a number of things that have been happening. We've got immigrants' rights groups, Juntos and New Sanctuary Movement, who have both been leading the charge in terms of support for immigrants in our city, also organizing rapid response groups and trainings, like was mentioned. And then we have all of the street actions that we've seen, right? January 23rd was massive. That was the day that Minneapolis went on strike. And we had a solidarity action in Philadelphia where folks across all kinds of organizations and, you know, across the political spectrum came together to show their support for Minneapolis and demand an end to ICE all across the country.
Yeah, that's really beautiful. I'd love to know a little bit more if you could elaborate on what rapid response has actually looked like in Philly. So how have people been organizing to protect the community?
Yeah, that's a great question. Like we said earlier, since we haven't seen the same scale of an invasion as Minneapolis or LA or Chicago. These rapid response groups are definitely still in their forming stages. They're coming together. Different groups have been providing Know Your Rights trainings. And then neighborhood groups are starting to meet in person to kind of figure out what that looks like in their community, right? Every neighborhood is different, but it will take all of us, immigrant, non-immigrant, standing up to ICE. Minneapolis also had some really inspiring tactics from neighborhood groups. So worth digging into what the organizers there have done so we can learn those lessons and bring them here to Philly because ICE will eventually escalate here if, you know, we haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that I was also kind of curious about was what have direct actions looked like, especially here in Philadelphia?
Yeah, absolutely. So the No ICE Coalition was formed in September with a bunch of community activists coming together specifically to target ICE. We've had direct actions, protests at City Hall, calling on local leaders to, you know, make some changes. We have some really exciting legislation I believe we'll talk about a little later. But then other direct actions have included a campaign for the sheriff's office to take security at the courthouse more seriously. Like I said earlier, over 100 community members have been abducted, coming or going from, you know, their legal immigration status hearings, right? Like they are going through the process correctly. They are trying their best to become citizens in the legal channels, and they're being abducted at the courthouse, which is the sheriff's department's kind of jurisdiction there. So actions calling on her to step up safety at the courthouse, as well as ongoing noise demonstrations outside of the ICE office. And then recently, we've also seen some pickets against companies who are collaborating with ICE. Target is a big one. They're headquartered in Minnesota, and we're collaborating with ICE there. And had a very large contract with them. The PPA also has a $50,000 contract for ICE to use their parking facilities. So we had a picket at the PPA last week. And then recently I've seen Enterprise is also collaborating with ICE with rentals and space usage as well. So telling those companies that we don't support their support of ICE has been a big site of action in Philadelphia.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to kind of elaborate a little bit more, I'm curious about like how the strategy, the organizing strategy has really changed over the last year and in recent months. How have the groups started to look different in response to ICE's increased presence and actions?
Yeah, great question. Like I said, the No ICE Coalition was formed in September. I want to say the first meeting had maybe 30 people. The first one I attended was in December. We had maybe 100 folks come out. And then the meeting right after Renee Good was murdered had almost 500 people in the room at the Friends Center downtown. So definitely folks are feeling the need to get involved, get organized. It has been a very collaborative effort to come up with what the pressure points are for the movement. Without having as much of an escalation as Minneapolis or LA, the tactics are a little more in solidarity with those places that have a more active presence right now. But all of that is in service of getting organized to fight back on the ground directly, because, again, we may see those kinds of escalations here in our city as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for that answer. So you touched on this a little bit, but I'd love to dig in a little bit more. Philadelphia City Council recently introduced a package of anti-ICE legislation to limit ICE activities in the city. And I would love if you could break down a little bit about what these bills actually do, what they don't do, and maybe what more could be done on a local legislative level.
Yeah, great question. We should absolutely be proud of that legislative package. It did a couple of really positive things. Keeping ICE off of public property is huge. A number of other things led by Kendra Brooks and the Working Families Party in conjunction with those immigrants' rights groups we've mentioned a couple times. That said, Minnesota had a lot of those same protections in place. Things like body cameras or ICE identifying themselves more clearly. We absolutely need those things, but it has not stopped ICE from murdering folks in the streets. It has not stopped them from detaining thousands of people, including many American citizens, right? Folks who've immigrated legally, folks who are just getting picked up for being brown, right? And so it's going to take community movements in the streets, like we saw in Minneapolis, like we're starting to build here in Philly, to really prevent those things from happening, right? Even a lot of the observations that folks are doing, right, recording stuff for the court system, while that is positive and absolutely needed, that's a defensive action, right? That family whose, family member has been abducted then has to go through the court system and wait weeks, if not months, to get any justice for that family member who was unfairly abducted, right? If we build strong movements and coalitions, we can keep the escalations from getting to that point in the first place.
Okay, thank you. So I think media and the social media has been desensitizing us, because it's always over there in Minneapolis, over there in California. But then until it's, wait a minute, that's here. So I live in Delaware County, and there has been a large immigrant population, and about 11% of the residents were born in another country. And in some areas like Upper Darby, almost a quarter of the residents are immigrants. And they always keep the attention on Philadelphia, Minnesota, all that, the big press. But there have been hundreds of people who have been detained right here in Delaware County, Philadelphia area, and Upper Darby. So what should people in the smaller cities in suburban or rural areas need to know?
Yeah, absolutely. Those abductions and detentions are just as awful as the ones happening in more high-profile places, right? All of our community members deserve safety, deserve a chance to become citizens legally if that's what they want. And I think folks need to know, again, that like our power is in the collective, right? There are always folks doing this work. I think your point about watching things come closer and closer is really real, right? We've had the war in Gaza for the last 2 years, like you said, desensitizing folks to this violence. But it's all related, right? We have so much more in common across the working class from Philadelphia to Delco to Minneapolis than any of us have in common with ICE or the Trump administration who is pushing this violence on us.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you for that answer. So one of the things that's been happening is with all this media coverage, it's been really overwhelming is that there's kind of been a lot of panic, misinformation that's been swirling. So I'd love if you could clear up some of the misconceptions that people might have about immigration, ICE, protests, and maybe some tips on how people could communicate information in effective ways if they want to be helpful.
Absolutely. Like I said, the folks doing kind of know your rights and basic safety trainings are a great place to start. There have been some best practices shared in the ICE groups that I'm in, like using a it's called a salute format when you share about any ICE presence. It's just a way to be as specific as possible so that organizers on the ground can respond appropriately. The other thing I would say is joining an organization, whatever that looks like in your area, whatever is available to you, getting involved with an organization, both to help cut through all of the misinformation that's out there, right? If you're doing this work alongside other people, you get to learn from their experiences. And then also you have that collective space to learn yourself, to make mistakes yourself. And then, you know, it's a tool to push the movement forward as a whole. That said, there is so much out there on the internet, it can be difficult, but finding people that you trust in an organization that aligns with your values is a great place to start.
Absolutely. And just really quickly, I don't know if you know what the acronym is, but do you think you'd be able to share what the salute method is?
I don't know off the top of my head, right. But it's, you know, location, how many officers, what they're wearing, things like that. Juntos, I believe, is the one running the phone line in Philadelphia. So there's a phone number you can call if you do spot ICE, and having that information on hand is super helpful. A quick Google will get you the full acronym.
Awesome. Thank you.
Awesome. What do you want our listeners to take away from the information they received today?
Yeah, great question. I think that the point about this getting closer and closer to us in here in Philadelphia, as well as you know, the solidarity that is needed to push back against ICE and then, you know, whatever other austerity and budget cuts and, you know, slashing of the services that we actually need. It's going to take all of us and it's going to take you, right? That can look different for everybody, but it will take all of us. And finding out how you can get involved before things are really right on your doorstep is going to be much better than waiting and getting lost in the news cycle.
Absolutely. Thank you so much to Effie for taking the time to speak with us today. Do you have any last bits that you want to share with folks?
Yeah, last bit is a plug for New Sanctuary Movement's event tomorrow, President's Day, January 16th. They're having a march and a vigil at 11 a.m. starting at the ICE office. You can find more on their Instagram, which is NSM Philly on Instagram.
Awesome. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Brad Linder is Radio News Managing Editor for WPPM. Peter Liu is Radio Operations Manager. And Allison Durham is WPPM's Radio Program Manager. And I am Amanda Johnson.
And I'm Campbell Simmons. Thanks to Winter Schneider, who is our board operator for this episode.
Around the Block will be back next month with another episode featuring more stories and conversations from our team of Philadelphia area community journalists. And you can find more episodes of Block by Block on PhillyCam SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you find your podcasts.
Thank you for listening.